From the studios of EWTN, this is Open Line with today's host, Colin Donovan. In North America, call toll-free 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 55000 or send an email to openline@ewtn.com.
A tremendous Friday to each and every one of you. Thanks so much for tuning in to EWTN's Open Line. The number to be on the program is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, your number is 1-205-271-2985, and we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. You can always send us an email, openline@ewtn.com, or you can text your question, text the letters EWTN to 55000. Wait for a response, text your first name and your question, message, and data rates may apply. I'm Jack Williams, Michael McCall producing the program. Your call screener is Matt Gubensky and Jeff Burson handling our social media efforts. So if you're watching us on YouTube or Facebook Live, you can type a question into the chat window and it may find its way to us by the end of the program. And our host, week number two of reentry, Colin Donovan, live in the studio. Does Andrea know you're here?
She does.
Okay.
She does.
All
I had
right.
to get permission to leave the house, but
okay.
You know.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, you know how that is.
I do. Well,
no.
not entirely. I know what it is to be asked to leave the house. But there's a little difference between asking to leave the house and being asked to leave the house.
That's true. That's
yeah.
true.
We have an email here from Rebecca. She says, "How can the Catholic Church differentiate an immortal soul and a non-rational animal soul? Aren't all souls immortal?"
No, because the expression soul with regard to the case of material beings such as animals, minerals, plants, and so on, refers to what gives it its particular nature, and it's entirely a material form. In other words, obviously, with biology today and with chemistry and physics, we understand the material processes which bring it about and form the matter. In the case of the human beings, the presence of our animal elements, our body, is not sufficient to make a man. We need the infusion of a soul. And so that's why scientists can talk about hominids that existed before human beings, because there were animals that had human-like bodies, but they were not human beings. They did not have the rational soul. And so that's the difference. Things can occur in nature by processes built in, and therefore by the will of God, who designed the laws of nature, and probably the angels who help him in carrying it out in the universe. But when it comes to each one of us, it takes the intervention of God to give that nature an existence.
We have an email from Nate. He says, "How can the saints be our intercessors, and how can Mary protect us?"
Well, because they are in God, they converse with God intellectually in their souls, and one day certainly even in bodily form after the general resurrection, we too will probably use our organs of speech to talk to our Lord or our Lady. But being in God, they protect us in and through God. So ultimately, you would say, as with all causes, the ultimate cause is going to be God, and even in the spiritual order, the ultimate cause of God. So our prayers of intercession and our pleading on with God and asking for his favor, his protection, and other things is like the case of the angels in the book of Revelation, where we're told that they are offering their prayers to God. God allows them to share in his glory, the glory of the kingship of Christ, by being mediators, subordinate to God and to Christ, but nonetheless being in that process of bringing before God the needs, the causes, and so on of human beings. And they do that. But ultimately, the final cause of all good in the universe and the blessings we receive is going to be God himself.
Here's an interesting question. Linda wants to know, at the Transfiguration, where did Moses and Elijah come from since they weren't in heaven? Is there anything in tradition to let us know?
Well, only in the tradition that we know that they were in the limbo of the patriarchs, the place of the just that Jesus went to when while his body was in the tomb, where Joseph went to and John the Baptist went to. And Joseph, as some of the mystics have alleged, is the one who got to announce to them that the Messiah was coming. Of course, he had held the Messiah in his arms. And so they were there. God can make them appear as the disembodied saints who are in heaven now appear to mystics. And so even from that place of waiting for the coming of the Messiah, they were able to appear on the Mount of Transfiguration. And if you think about it, it's very fitting that it was they that was chosen to represent the old law, because Moses and Elijah were to the people of Israel. They were prime representatives, Moses the lawgiver, Elijah the greatest prophet, and together they were able to represent to the three apostles that this indeed was the Messiah that they had hoped for, looked forward to, for, and that was now on earth carrying out his mission.
Robbie says, on the topic of apostolic succession, which I didn't know we were on it, but I guess we are now.
Must have been that day. When
once James died, why didn't he get replaced?
Well, because his particular ministry as apostle was irreplaceable. Christ chose the apostle. He chose 12. The apostles elected Matthias, and then Christ appeared to Paul. And so while the apostles were alive, they could choose a replacement, and they did in Matthias. And Christ chose a 13th apostle, St. Paul, perhaps in order to fulfill the nature of Israel. Israel essentially had 12 tribes, but 13 patriarchs, because the two sons of Joseph constituted each one of them a portion of Israel. And so in a way we see that parallel in the 13 apostles, disregarding Judas who fell away. And so once they left this earth as the witnesses of the mystery of the resurrection, there was nobody left, there was nobody who could replace them. And so that's why Matthias was chosen among those who were the witnesses. Paul was given a personal witness of the resurrection by Christ. And so what ended up happening is that after the apostles, what we have is the episcopoi, the overseers, the bishops. And so thus we see in the letters of Paul and in the Acts of the Apostles that they went and they appointed bishops and overseers and presbyters, elders, in the places that they went to carry on their ministry. But with the apostles themselves, the revelation in and through Jesus Christ ended, because with them ended the witnesses of the resurrection.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. Just getting started on an open line Friday. Plenty of open phone lines for you at 833-288-EWTN. Patricia asks, if the church recognizes baptisms and marriages of non-Catholics, why doesn't it recognize non-Catholic communion as being the body and blood of Christ?
Baptism is a sacrament which anybody can minister. Many a Jewish nurse in a hospital, at the request of the parents, administered baptism to the dying child, doing what they were told to do and intending what the parents wanted to be done, and the parents, of course, intending what the church wanted to be done. You do not even have to be a Catholic to do that. Protestants can do that as well. But some of the sacraments...
You really don't even have to be a Christian.
You don't even have to be a Christian, exactly. That's the point. Some of the sacraments require a validly ordained ministry who shares in the power of the keys given to the successors of the apostles, which we talked about, and shared with the priests as their associates in their ministry. And without that power, certain of the sacraments, confirmation and Eucharist and penance and anointing of the sick, can't be accomplished. You can be married because that takes two baptized people, and it's the people, the couple minister the sacrament to themselves.
Holy orders?
Holy orders is yes, also one that can't be replaced other than by a valid bishop who can consecrate a new priest.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. It's a free phone call anywhere in North America. 833-288-3986. If you're outside of North America, that number is 1-205-271-2985. And if you are outside of North America, we'll even put you just straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. It's EWTN's Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan in persona theologica right here on EWTN's Open Line.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. If you have a question, call 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985 or send us an email to openline@ewtn.com.
You know, you can stay informed and educated with the latest news and truth on abortion, euthanasia, assisted suicide, and the entire culture of death right here on EWTN's Pro-Life Weekly with Catherine Hadrow. And we can actually send EWTN's Pro-Life Weekly directly to your email inbox every week. Just visit EWTN.com and click on subscribe. We've got three open phone lines for you at 833-288-EWTN. They will not remain vacant long, so pick up your phone and give us a call at 833-288-3986. First up today is Bassam in Detroit, Michigan, listening on Ave Maria Radio. Bassam, thanks so much for holding. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Colin. Appreciate taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome.
God bless your ministry.
Thank you.
When the pandemic hit, we weren't allowed to go to Mass.
Right.
And then we did it online. Now we're okay doing Masses, but I used to go daily Mass, but since the pandemic, I'm still doing it online other than Sundays. Is that still acceptable way of attending Mass, if you may?
Well, it's not really attending Mass. That's the important thing. And I think one of the concerns that the bishops had, and I'm sure the in Rome as well, was when things opened up again, as they have in our country, at least in many places, will people actually return to the parishes? I think they will when they feel comfortable returning and so on. In the sacramental system, although there are pious graces, if you want to call them, for doing anything that's done devoutly, saying your rosary, reading your scripture, watching Mass on television, whether from EWTN or the many parishes and cathedrals across the country that have streaming Masses on the weekends, for example, on Sunday. We've done that as well as our own cathedral. Those things are substitutes. They're not sacramental participation in the Mass. And I think Catholics need to understand that, that we are present at the representation of the holy sacrifice of the cross by sacramentally participating in Mass, whether we're in the front row of a large papal gathering or in the hinterlands, you know, a half a mile away from the Holy Father, you're still present. There is a human presence there in being together with the minister and with the others, worshiping the Father in and through Jesus Christ. And so that is the nature of a sacramental participation. Likewise with communion, sacramental communion is not can't be substituted by spiritual communion. Spiritual communion is great. Many of the saints made the offering the spiritual communion prayer or something like it many, many times a day. There is no limit to how many spiritual communions you can make. The church allows one, and if you are able to attend a second Mass, a second Holy Communion, because it's a unique situation. It doesn't want us to be, you know, overly familiar with it and take it for granted. So I think we're going to be sort of in an educational mode for a while to get to the point where we take that desire to go to Mass, and maybe it overcomes the psychological obstacles and the physical obstacles to actually getting to Mass. And you're the judge of that, and I think most dioceses that's understood. Particular concerns can be talked with your pastor about, you know, with regard to the way that the church is managed, and we're sort of still in the pandemic, but sliding out of it, hopefully. You know, these kinds of things are local kinds of things that can be talked about with the pastor, with the bishop. So try to get back, because as wonderful it is to be able to watch the Mass online, it's not a substitute for actually sacramentally participating in the Holy Eucharist, much less receiving our Lord in the Holy Eucharist sacramentally.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. Christine is in Chicago, Illinois, listening on WSFI Radio. Christine, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Yes. Well, a priest gives the penance in a confession. Do they ever say the psalms, or say give a psalm for the person to say? And if they do, if the priest would say, the Lord is my shepherd, twice, what do you say two, the Lord is my shepherd? Or mm-hmm. Now, like in my prayer book, too, I have after the rosary, it's just say one Hail, Holy Queen. Well, what if the priestess says two Hail, Holy Queens? Would that be okay to say, you're okay to say that? Or do you, what do you say? Yeah.
Right. Now, if the rosary is given as a penance, or if you say the rosary privately, the rosary is the five decades. So the prayers that come after it and the prayers before are not technically part of the rosary. Pope John Paul II made this clear in a document on the rosary that he put out during his pontificate. So if you're told to say the rosary, it's to say the five decades, to say the prayers before and after are beautiful and a great thing, but they're not obligatory for saying the rosary, you know, under the title of the rosary. As far as what the priest gives in the sacrament of confession as a penance, that's really up to him. And I think we've all been given prayers to do or been told to open the missalette and read the, you know, the gospel of the day and spend 5 minutes reflecting on it or something like that. You know, usually I've heard priests when they sometimes, especially in pious communities.
I usually get like 3 weeks with a hair shirt.
I figured that, but... You know, a priest used to say when he would go to hear the prayers, the penance, the confessions of the sisters, not in this community here, but elsewhere, well, now I'm going to go dust some angel wings. And a lot of people are just dusting their angel wings when they make a devotional confession. And the priest may not give you a big penance. If he gives you a psalm to say or a couple psalms to say, I think he probably thinks he's dusting angel wings. So you're probably doing pretty good, you know, if you're not being asked like Jack to wear a hair shirt for 3 weeks.
You know, it's funny. Our good friend Dr. Ray Guarendi tells the story, quote unquote story, all the time when he's out speaking. Is he talks about his lovely wife Randy, who is doing her purgatory here on Earth. having gone to confession and came home, and he was trying to figure out what she had confessed, and he asked her, and she said, I'm not telling you what I confessed. That's not what this is about. So he figured he could come in the back door and maybe figure out what was going on from the penance that she got, right? So he said, so what did you get for a penance? And she said, the priest asked me to say the Divine Mercy Chaplet. And so he's thinking, oh, well, that's pretty substantial, but it's not horrible or anything like that. And he said, and then she said, with a rosary after every bead. And he says, I wish I'd have known this before I married you. So Anyway.
I think she was repeating the old joke about a Franciscan and a Jesuit who were trying to outdo each other and giving each other penances. Yes. Smart woman.
833-288-EWTN. Next up is Gloria in Dallas, Texas. She's listening on Guadalupe Radio. Gloria, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Hi. Thanks for being here. A wonderful radio show. For my call is that last week it was the feast day of Our Lady of the Rosary, and my husband and I were on vacation in Florida, and we went to a church for daily mass, and I am very concerned about what I witnessed there, because when I left, I had to ask someone if it was, in fact, a Roman Catholic mass. We found some irregularities, the biggest of which was when the priest was consecrating the precious blood, he said something along the lines of, "This is the blood of the covenant that will be poured out for you and for all of us." He did not say for you and for many. And that really made me take pause, because I didn't know if that was a valid consecration. And there were a couple other irregularities, like when he first came to the front, up at the altar.
Sure.
He actually went into such an elaborate greeting to all of us that were there. He forgot to start the Mass with the sign of the cross. And he just was very interesting, a real character.
Yeah. Sounds like there's a pocket of the 1970s somewhere in Florida. It sounds like it was valid. If you read in the dogmatic history what's generally be considered reduced to the validity, it's to state what is being done. And so, "This is my body." The priest is holding the bread. He's saying the words of Christ. This bread is my body. And this cup, repeating the word, "This is the chalice of my blood." So this is my blood. That would be considered the essential form, those four words in the case, "This is," and "my bread," or my blood. And so the other things, it's still a liturgical abuse. The priest is obliged to use the liturgical books of the church according to the words that the church gives him. It's not his mass. It's Christ's mass, the church's mass. The church has authority, the Apostolic See. Second Vatican Council taught this very clearly in its document on the liturgy. So it's not modern or with it to change the words in the text, which the Second Vatican Council said no authority but the Apostolic See can do that. And so that's a liturgical abuse, but it sounds that the sufficient was there to speak of the validity of the consecration.
And sometimes in these situations when, there are some individuals who choose to work from memory as opposed to actually putting their eyes on the page in the book, and sometimes that can lead to drifting back to previous translations, which the first incident that she mentions would have been essentially the previous translation.
Or some version of it. Yeah, and especially for an older priest. So taking into account, it would still be an irregularity and unjustified, but there can be the human explanations for it as well.
Gloria, I don't know if it'll help you at all or not, but our old friend, the former Rosalind Moss, now Mother Miriam of the Lamb of God, she once told me that whenever I was fussing about a similar situation once with her, and she said that she understood how I felt, but she said when she finds herself in situations like that, what she tried to do, and she said, "I'm not always successful," but she says, "What I try to do in those situations is I try to tell myself, this is the body and blood of Jesus Christ, and I am not worthy to receive it."
Yeah.
And she said that usually was a pretty good way to bring herself back.
It's a good remedy, yeah, because in the end, and I think people of our vintage have been to a lot of abusive masses over the decades, and you sort of get used to it to a certain extent, but not used to it. And so that you need a mechanism like that, and I think that's a good and holy way of approaching it.
Thanks, Gloria. We appreciate the phone call. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Give us a call at 833-288-3986. It's Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
couple of open phone lines for you and plenty of time for your calls for Colin Donovan at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. It's not an official episode of Open Line until we get a call from a Mary. And we've got our Mary call from the great state of Connecticut, listening on Veritas Radio. Mary, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I have a couple of questions about purgatory.
Okay.
One is, if you are lucky enough to make the purgatory, could you still end up in hell? And my other question is, in some way, is purgatory a happy place because you know that you might get to heaven, or is it just really sad because you didn't get there directly?
No, I think it's a happy place. You know, a lot of the saints were interminably happy. I don't know if that's a proper conjunction of adjective and that together, but even though they had great suffering, and that it's a mystery how very good people suffer with equanimity. And the way the saints do it on earth is they live their purgatory on earth. What we do in heaven is we live that, or what we do in purgatory, we live that, not on earth, but afterwards in purgatory. And so you're on your way to heaven, and you're being purified, because as we're told— Irrevocably on your way to heaven, and you're being purified, because nothing impure shall enter into the heavenly Jerusalem, we're told by St. John in his book of Revelation at the end. And so you're being purified to enter. Those who go to hell are those who end their life at enmity with God. And it's irreformable in them. You are those in purgatory are inevitably on their way to heaven. Those who go to hell are irretrievably in hell.
And, you know, it's funny. It just occurred to me. There's a famous quote that we play often on the radio from Mother Angelica. And you talk about some people living their purgatory on earth, and we hear that term quite frequently, and we think of their sufferings, right?
Right.
But it can also relate to the joy that you're speaking about or the happiness that you're speaking about in purgatory, because Mother Angelica has that famous quote that she told her sisters, if it ever came down to me being on artificial machines or life support, she said, I want to be hooked up to every machine that you can possibly find to keep me alive, because I know that the day that I die and leave this earth, I will never be able to suffer for him again.
Yeah. And that's the way a saint thinks about those kinds of issues. You know, and the other part of that is that if you read a little bit on the mystical life in the writings of the saints or books that talk about Father Dubé's programs, which for years we aired here on EWTN, what you find out is that once you have overcome all the material agencies of sin, the greed, the avarice, the lust, and so on, the roots of that are in the spirit, and the worst suffering doesn't come in the flesh, but in the spirit, being purified out. And that's the same suffering of the souls in purgatory, and the saints accomplish that on earth. Mother always used to say about purgatory, you know, don't aim for it. You might miss.
Yeah.
Aim for heaven. That way, if you miss, well, there's always purgatory.
That's right. That's right. Does that help, Mary?
Absolutely. One thing that my father used to say, he wanted to go to purgatory because he didn't think he was worthy to go straight to heaven, and he wanted that purification. So,
well, if he needs it or needed it, he'll get it. So there's no skipping it if you need it.
God bless you, Mary. We appreciate the phone call. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. Next up is Michael in Mobile, Alabama, listening on Archangel Radio. Michael, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Yes, thank you, gentlemen. I have a question that bothering me. I just need a concise answer to it. You know, growing up Catholic, I always, you know, thought the church was called Roman Catholic. And, you know, then I dug a little deeper and I found out that's really started as a derogatory term by the Protestants, you know, around the Reformation. And then, you know, when I hear Protestants speak in a less than positive fashion about Catholics, they make it a point to use the term Roman Catholic. And I also hear Catholics use the term Roman Catholic describing the whole church, not just the Western Rite, which I tend to cringe a little because I've always felt it kind of alienated our Eastern Catholic brothers. So what is the church position on the term Roman Catholic?
Except in the English-speaking world, it doesn't really use the term because in the church's documents and in the creed, we are one holy Catholic and apostolic church. That comes out of the way the church described itself by the different turns in the early centuries. It was Catholic because it was universal. It was Orthodox because it was faithful to the truth. And, of course, after the split with the Eastern churches, there tended to be the emphasis on Orthodoxy and the emphasis on Catholicity, the universality. The only difficulty being that we took the successor of St. Peter, who Christ appointed the chief of the apostles, with us. So when we're speaking of the whole church, we're speaking of the Catholic Church. A little bit of a distinction on the origins of Roman. I wouldn't say it started out as a derogatory term so much as actually a term to claim to be as Catholic as Rome and as Catholic as the Eastern churches in terms of its apostolic origins. And the basis of that was the Anglican Church and the branch theory, that there were three branches of the Catholic Church. There is the Eastern branch, which we identify as the Orthodox. There is the Roman branch, which we identify as the Roman. And there is the Anglican branch. And so in these three branches together, the whole church is made up. So it's actually a positive expression. It's trying to say, well, the Anglicans wanting to claim they were this third branch of the church, the Anglican Catholic Church. And many of them took that name, especially in the beginning in the 1800s. Anglo-Catholic usually means a little more high church than low Anglo-Catholic Anglicans. Than the low church Anglicans who are more Protestant in their orientation. So it started out in a good way. It's not an official term of the church at all, although in the English-speaking world it pretty much is used very commonly. And there's nothing wrong with the different usages. Like you, I tend to avoid referring to the Roman Catholic Church, although that's a valid term. There is an expression that has sometimes been used historically. One holy and Catholic and Roman church, or one, well, if I get the phrasing right, one holy apostolic Rome, Catholic and Roman church to put all of those things together. But really, it is true that the Roman Rite generally is more legitimately at least called the Roman Catholic, and the Eastern Catholics referring then to the Eastern Rites. Nothing terribly wrong with the application of the term to the whole, though.
I know there's a very prominent evangelical person in America that won't say the word Catholic. He'll only say the Roman Church when he refers to us.
Yeah, well, wrong on many things, wrong on one, right?
There you go. Thanks a lot, Michael. We appreciate the phone call. David is in Spokane, Washington, listening to us today on Sirius XM Channel 130. David, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Hi, good afternoon, guys. I appreciate your ministry and taking my call today. I just had a question regarding public office and stances like pro-abortion in your policy making and in your fundraising activities and just your outward public life and claiming to be a good and faithful Catholic. Most notably, I think everybody's probably heard in the news that President Biden is going to be meeting with the Pope very soon. And I know that the USCCB has started a study group to see what is a proper response. But I was wondering, you know, as a good and faithful Catholic myself, but being sinful as well, this is kind of a scandal for me, like to have a president, a person in public office that claims to be a good and faithful Catholic, campaigns on that, and yet, you know, publicly they hold something contrary to the faith and they promote something actively contrary to the faith. What is the doctrinal what am I trying to say? The doctrinal process for an official excommunication proclamation by a bishop.
Sure. Right. It wouldn't be a doctrinal case. It's a canonical situation. There are only certain things which are offenses which have the most serious of penalties from the church. Many things will say if you do X, Y, and Z, you know, and you're convicted of that, so to speak, then a just penalty is applied. But there are certain things which are automatic, an apostate from the faith, a heretic, or a schismatic. These assume overt, unrepentant acts where, despite appeals to the conscience of the person, they don't reform themselves. Obviously, when one has that attitude in your own heart, you can have committed these mortal sins against the faith, against the truth, against the sacraments, or against the authority of the church, a schismatic. You can be guilty of these before God and yet not publicly remonstrated by the church. And in that middle situation between being in full communion and living it outside overtly and so on, until something is declared, the church generally doesn't treat the person according to the canonical penalty. It would have to get to the point where they say, this is deserving for these reasons to deal with this person at the level of canon law, to follow those steps and procedures, to judge them by a process which would do that, and then to proclaim that judgment. Now, there are other ways in which you sometimes hear, for example, that a priest who leaves the Catholic Church and marries without the permission of the church is excommunicated automatically. The bishop or the Holy See generally will announce something like that to make it clear, this guy you can no longer go to for your sacraments because he's been excommunicated from the church because of what he did, which is a violation of the canon, which attaches a excommunication to it. And there are a number of these in the sanctions. These are in the 1360s and 70s and so on of the Code of Canon Law. So we would have to see that done. I think, yeah, scandal is something which people take, not always properly. St. Thomas says passive scandal itself is wrong because, you know, the holy person realizes that they too are sinners and whatever sin somebody else has done, I shouldn't be scandalized by it because that means move to sin myself. So unless this is moving you to sin, then yes, you're bothered by it. You think these kinds of things shouldn't happen. I hope you're not scandalized in the strict sense of that, being moved to sin because of the behavior of others. That's what would be intended there. In the cases of politicians meeting with the Pope or the bishops' conferences dealing with them, in the case of their public capacities, they don't represent themselves. They represent the United States. They represent their office and so on. The Pope meets with anybody who wants to talk to him, any world leader, regardless of the circumstances of that. What the bishops will do in our own country, that's for the bishops to decide, and they are pondering this, as you mentioned, because people are, their faith, their own faith is weakened. That's a case of being scandalized because they think, well, what does it matter that, you know, to me, why am I a Catholic if whatever you do or whatever you believe doesn't really matter anymore? You know, so that's the real scandal there. And so some people are moved to have a weak faith because of, you know, a failure to deal with these situations. But canonically, what is required for excommunication to be declared, a declared excommunication, that's a process. It obviously includes the dogmatic element. Is this person denying some truth that is central to the faith? In the case of abortion, it doesn't apply because unless they actually do an abortion, it is not currently a canonical crime. I personally think it ought to be. I think anybody who assists the culture of death to advance itself, whether it's abortion, euthanasia, in vitro fertilization, or whatever it is, that ought to be sanctionable. But that's not the case now, and that would be not those who do it necessarily. Even in the case of abortion, the woman is unlikely to be punished by the church, all the factors there. But those who are more seriously guilty of it, the doctors, the nurses, they formally cooperate, of course. But what about the politicians? I think a good case can be made that promoting these things is excommunicatable. And if in country A, B, or C, people want to elect them to office, that's their decision. But I think it makes it at least clear who is in and outside the church in terms of a legitimate stance on the greatest issue of all, at least at the natural level, life. Are you protecting it, or are you trying to end it or make it easy to end, or making it a matter of the self-judgment of individuals? That, to me, ought to be spelled out in the law as criminal.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. It's a free phone call anywhere in North America, 833-288-3986. Be sure to check out EWTN News In Depth tonight at 8 Eastern. You can tune in for an exploration of the relationship between the Catholic Church and Indigenous Americans as Bishop James S. Wall of the Diocese of Gallup in New Mexico discusses the USCCB's plan for the church to better meet the needs of Native American communities, address issues of injustice, and promote more vocations within these communities. That's EWTN News In Depth with Monse Alvarado tonight, 8 Eastern Time, right here on EWTN Radio and Television. Ken would like to know, can we pray for the intercession of someone who died in the faith but is not canonized?
Yes, you can have a private devotion. I think we all know very holy people who have died, Mother Angelic, for example. They may or may not ever be canonized, but that private devotion is permissible. It ought to be a credible private devotion. Praying to a person who is very unlikely to be in heaven or in purgatory, that would make no sense whatsoever. But yes, for those kinds of private prayer situations, yes, it is indeed permitted.
Mark is in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, listening on Oklahoma Catholic Broadcasting. Mark, welcome to the program. You're on with Colin.
Hello, sir.
Hey, Mark, what's your question today?
So my question is that my wife and I are wanting to, but whoever goes first, we know the kids are going to eventually relocate. And I know that when you're cremated, you should be put into a Catholic cemetery, but can those ashes still be held in an urn at home until those, so that we can both be put together in whatever location.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, not really. The movement of the deceased is not all that uncommon. You think of all of we were just talking about saints and that. They very often, they will dig up the remains, both for part of the investigation, but also to put them in a place of honor. So that element of it, the moving of it, is done. It's certainly something to be discussed with your pastor. But I think something, you know, if you think this is a possibility, you need to just, you know, be buried. You can't think that much about the future, I don't think. If they ever wish to have the move, your remains move from one burial location, whether in the ground or a columbarium, to another, that's something that is feasible. But just as you wouldn't just sort of keep the casket laying around the house, you shouldn't keep the remains of the dead in an urn on your mantle or around the house either. So that was not legitimate. You're deserving. The respect that is owed to you is more than being, you know, a mantle decoration, even for the legitimate purpose that someday when your kids move away somewhere, what if they move, you know, several different places, you know, one here, one there, somewhere else? Who knows? They might want to just come back to their hometown. what a great way to get your kids to come back and visit you after you're dead, you know, is have a decent burial and be placed where you are, where you lived, and where you pass away.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. It's a free phone call anywhere in North America, 833-288-3986. Dave is in Centerville, Ohio, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Dave, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Yes, Colin. When you were talking about the Anglicans and the branch theory, you left us with the idea that Anglicans are Catholics.
They have the idea they're Catholics.
Yes, but
and that's how
not.
The term came into use. Of course they aren't.
Oh, you say they're Catholic?
No, I said of course they aren't.
They aren't.
This is how the expression got started. So we were talking about the expression, not the reality. In thinking themselves a branch of the greater church and justifying their break with Rome, they refer to now to Catholics as Roman Catholics, and of course, they being Anglo-Catholics. It's not true, but this is the origin of the distinction in English, which is why it's all mostly in the English-speaking world. So it wasn't justifying the Anglicans in any respect whatsoever. In fact, Leo XIII made it clear that Anglican orders are invalid as a result of the Protestantizing of the texts they received from the days when they were Catholic, and they got changed in a Protestant direction to no longer explicitly intend to ordain bishops, priests, and deacons as the church has historically understood them to be, a sacrificing priesthood, for example. And in doing that, those men that were ordained, and of course in our own day women, which also invalid, they're not valid clergy. And Leo XIII made that clear in the 1890s when the question came up whether there was any possibility whatsoever that the Anglican Catholics, those who High Church Anglicans, could be considered valid priesthood. No, they could not be because of the intention of the church in ordaining them. And that was broken during the time of Elizabeth back in the 15 into the 1600s.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Yeah, that clears it up. And then I have a question.
Okay.
Instead of a mass, sometimes at our church, we have a Catholic church, we have a communion service, and there's this one lady, and she puts on a white garment. Is that a surplice?
No, that'd be the alb. Hello?
As everything in the Mass except the consecration.
So she says the Eucharistic prayer except for the consecration?
She doesn't do the consecration, but she'll give a sermon and read the gospel. And I was wondering, is she allowed to give a sermon?
Right. It's not a homily because it's not a mass. So yes, but it's who is competent? I mean, the idea is that the better thing here is to read a prepared homily by the parish priest or something like this. The assumption that somebody makes that they're competent to speak in the name of the church in some capacity and give that, that exceeds their authority. With regard to the structure of a communion service, there is typically given a liturgy of the word, and then it proceeds to the communion rite with the prayers that precede the giving of communion, and then the Our Father, and so on, and then the distribution of communion. So there's no reason for an offertory. There is no reason for the Eucharistic prayer. So pretty much everything after the gospel and whatever little reflection they might will to offer, up to the Our Father is exempted because there's no reason for it, and it's presumptuous for a lay person to you know, to say prayers which have no purpose. They're not they're not preparing the offering, and they're not consecrating the bread.
But with those exclusions, a lay person can be legitimately deputed to
Right. It can be deputed generally by the bishop. By need, a priest can select a person to do that in a situation. There is actually a booklet put out by the Holy See, and it's in English, describing a what is and is not legitimate in that respect. And so every parish should have that booklet on the rites of the Holy Eucharist outside the Mass. Is what the subject matter is.
It's good to see you live and in living color.
It's good to see you, too. You've been away a week or so.
On behalf of our host, Colin Donovan, our producer, Michael McCall, our call screener, Matt Kubensky, and our social media maven, Mr. Jeff Burson, I'm Jack Williams. Thanks so much for another great week of EWTN's Open Line. Back at it Monday, Father John Trigilio in the house, Father Wade back on Tuesday. We'll talk to Father Mitch on Wednesday. Father Brian Milady on Thursday, and we'll wrap it up again next week with Colin Donovan here on Friday. Have a great weekend. Until we get together Monday, God bless.